Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Losing a loved one to murder is life's ultimate tragedy. But when the killer is never captured, a family's paralyzing grief only compounds. Years pass, pain grows. Time heals nothing. Parents, spouses, and children of the victims never find peace. Investigators continue to lie awake night after night, year after year, thinking, if only. Cold cases fascinate us because of the endless possibilities. What if Alice Hochhausler hadn't driven her daughter home from work while the strangler was running loose? What if Oda Apple's wife hadn't sent him to the corner drugstore? What if Linda Bricka hadn't been so beautiful and her husband not a workaholic? J.T. Townsend takes us on a sinister journey through 13 cases which took place in Cincinnati, Ohio between 1904 and 1971. You'll meet Frances Brady, a pretty bride-to-be, gunned down at her own front door. Tommy Kobe, age 8, who arrived home to an empty house and learned later his parents were lying dead in their car. Patty Rebolts, a popular cheerleader who was bludgeoned in a neighbor's backyard while walking to break up with her teenage boyfriend. What do these cases have in common? A fleeting, irrational act of violence with no resolution. Somebody literally got away with murder. Each episode took place in sheer moments, but hundreds of innocent people still remember, still mourn, and are still haunted by horrible, unbearable images. Townsend's riveting accounts include never-before-published details from police files and insights from both investigators and witnesses. Who done it? We'll never know for sure, but we can certainly make some informed, calculated guesses. Meanwhile, on these pages, each victim returns to vibrant life, becomes as real to us as those loved ones that they left behind, and still cries out for justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Queen City Gothic, Cincinnati's Most Infamous Murder Mysteries, with my special guest, journalist and author J.T. Townsend. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, J.T. Townsend.
Thank you, Dan. Glad to be here.
Thank you very much for coming on. Very, very fascinating book you have here. First off, just tell us how you came to be in a position to want to write this book. What drove you to or put you in the position to write Queen City Gothic?
Dan, that's a great question. You might say I turned to crime to beat cancer. I was a regular corporate working stiff in 2007. I got a colon cancer diagnosis. While taking chemotherapy, I decided to go through all my cold case clippings and write this book I'd been wanting to write. 6 months later, I was cancer-free, and I had a pretty bad first draft. A couple years of editing later, Queen City Gothic hit the market. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Interesting. Tell us what you have 13, you've submitted 13 of Cincinnati's unsolved, classic unsolved homicides. How were the 13 cases selected?
Well, I think I had a list of about 50. A lot of it had to do with media coverage at the time. A lot of it had to do with more prominent victims, more upper middle class neighborhoods, you know, everything that makes a good murder, you know, a hint of scandal, a whisper of sex, you know, a personal cause homicide, where the killer and the victim are somehow involved. And all of these cases in Queen City Gothic were front page fodder for weeks and months after these crimes occurred. I think probably the coverage more than anything else probably dictated which cases would make it in.
One quick question. What's with the name? What's the background or the history of the name Queen City for Cincinnati?
You know, that's a nickname Cincinnati's had, I think, since the mid-1800s. It was considered the gateway to the West. And the name just kind of stuck, the Queen City of the Midwest. And I don't know, it's kind of stuck all these years.
We're going to discuss in particular three of the incredible stories that are in the 13, just because we won't be able to cover too many of these fascinating stories. So we just, between us, picked these stories to highlight. And one you call in particular Terror in the Gaslight District, and this is about the Cincinnati Strangler, and the particular, one of the most, I guess, memorable cases in Cincinnati history for the horror and the terror that inflicted on the city because of the Cincinnati Strangler. So let's talk about the Cincinnati Strangler, and you start this in 1965. So tell us what's going on in the city, in the Queen City, at this time, and you talk about October 1965 and Elizabeth Krekko.
Right.
So tell us about what the city is like at that time, and then tell us a little bit about Elizabeth Krekko and what happened.
I tell you, if I was gonna give you a quick blurb, a conservative Midwestern city in the 1960s confronts a serial killer in its own burgeoning racial turmoil. No, this is not a John Grisham novel. It's the unknown legend of the Cincinnati Strangler. This was a major serial killer in 1966 that barely anyone has heard of.
Right.
Boston Strangler was well known from 62 to 64. The term serial killer had not yet been coined, but I think with the Boston Strangler, people started to realize that there were killers who did kill multiple victims with a passage of time. And suddenly, in October of 1965, we had a woman named Elizabeth Krekko attacked in the Walnut Hills neighborhood, strangled into unconsciousness, raped, but she did survive. And that is considered to be the beginning of the Cincinnati Strangler saga.
Now, what were some of the signatures and MO of this person right from the beginning? You say she was attacked, but she survived. So what was the description that was out there for police, and what was the description that they released, and how did the investigation proceed after this attack?
Well, she described her attacker as a short, slightly built black man. She was a white woman. The Strangler, as he moved through his series of crimes, was known to improvise a ligature. I think the ligature in each of the stranglings was different. A pair of stockings, a men's tie, the belt to a bathrobe, a clothesline. And he would be someone we describe as an unorganized offender, someone who would basically do just a little stalking, pick a victim of chance, kill the victim, leave them right where they were murdered, no attempt to cover up any clues or to cover his own trail. And that would contrast with an organized serial killer like a Ted Bundy, someone who had a lengthy stalking behavior, someone who took a victim and did not create a crime scene, take the victim across jurisdictional lines, jump the body somewhere. So that is not what we had in Cincinnati. We had someone operating in their own comfort zone, taking victims of chance, basically. And in this case, women that were 50 years of age and older.
Right. Yes, Elizabeth Krekko was 65 years old. You say that 9 days later, two more women were assaulted. Both of these attacks, you say, were these people reported that black males had assaulted them, but there were different descriptions.
There were.
And then you talk about October 20th.
This is in the... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Again, this is all in the Walnut Hills neighborhood, so it's been very confined at that point. Again, this similar description, short, slightly built black man, but was there facial hair? Was there not? Was he wearing a beret? Was he not? There was a lot of discrepancies in these descriptions. And, you know, so far we haven't had any fatalities. So Cincinnati really, at this point, okay, we've got some hit-and-run assaults, but I don't think anyone had an idea of really what was to come.
Right. Now, you talk about October 25th. There's another attack, Margie Hetton. She's 39 years old, and someone tried to put a rope around her neck. So
yes.
Tell us about that attack, and then the subsequent attack on December 2nd with Emma Jean Harrington, 56 years old.
Right. You know, Margie Hetton, again, in Walnut Hills, leaving work. And we've seen this in some of the other attacks. A young black man asks for street directions and then attacks the victim. In this case, he looped a rope around Margie Helton's neck, managed to steal $10, but she screamed, managed to hit her car horn. The attack was broken off. December 2nd, 1965, the first acknowledged victim of the Cincinnati Strangler was found. It was 56-year-old Emma Jean Harrington. She had just come home. It was a Thursday afternoon. The Claremont Apartments, very nice neighborhood, very nice, broad daylight. She went looking for the janitor of the building to help her carry in her groceries. And somewhere in the basement of this cavernous apartment building, she ran into the Cincinnati Strangler. She was hit a crushing blow to the head, taken down, raped, strangled, and left there in a basement restroom, and the janitor she'd been looking for found her body. She was the wife of an aerospace scientist at the University of Cincinnati, fairly prominent victim. So on December 2nd, we have our first murder in Walnut Hills.
You write that there's a double-knotted, very much a double knot, just very much like the Krakow rape. So
yeah, double knotted on each end, yeah.
So police make some connection very, very early on in these cases.
And all these attacks have, again, been in the Walnut Hills neighborhood of Cincinnati. Appears to be a comfort zone for this attacker. Again, a disorganized attacker is not going to go far away from his territory. So it's all confined to the Walnut Hills area, and we've got one near fatality, we've got one murder, and at least three or four attacks leading into the end of 1965. But again, I don't think Cincinnati really realizes what is in store at this point.
You write, by April 4th, 1966, you say the phantom struck again, and this is Lois Dant. She's 58 years old, and her husband just goes out for a short period of time and comes back. And tell us what he finds and what's the condition of his wife, Lois Dant.
Yeah. I tell you, Dan, this one bothers me. She and her husband were always together, except on Monday morning when he would go to the parish and help count the collection plate from Sunday. It's the only period of time during a week when she would be alone in her apartment, and that's when the strangler got her. Her husband came home, found her bludgeoned, raped, strangled with one of her own stockings. He just missed the killer. He was coming in the back door as the killer was leaving the front door. This one was interesting because the victim herself was able to tell us what was going on right before her murder. She was on the phone with her cousin, said there was a knock at the door. The cousin heard her answer the door. She came back on the phone and said it was some man looking for the caretaker. Talked with her cousin. Doorbell rings again. She said, well, maybe it's that same man. I'll call you later. She hangs up and goes to the door. And that's the killer. She opens the door to the killer. And, yes, her husband found her. I've seen the crime scene photos. Boy, no husband should ever have to see something like that. And, again, we've got the same improvised ligature, a blow to the head to take the victim down, then the strangulation and the rape, which in this case was posthumous. I believe the woman victim was almost already dead when the rape occurred. Now, this is on the west side of Cincinnati, Dan, in the Price Hill neighborhood. This is way across I-75 from where this offender has been operating. And this is a extremely, in 1966, a white neighborhood. And it's hard to believe a black man could have operated in this neighborhood in 1966 without attracting some attention. And I speculate that if a black man had been at her door, she might have mentioned that to her cousin. That would be a real singular experience in this neighborhood in 1966. So with this crime, you have a killer who appears to know that the victim will be alone. And you have a victim who really didn't appear to be alarmed at whoever this man at her door was. Makes me think that if it had been a black man, she would have mentioned that to her cousin, but she did not. So now we've got a second murder similar to the first. Cincinnati is starting to become a little tense about this.
You say that some police, though, hesitated to think the murder with the Harrington, to connect this murder with the Harrington murder. Why would that be?
Well, again, the fact that she was killed during such a tight window, when her husband is always with her except on Monday morning. And it seems like an odd time for a serial killer to be operating on a Monday morning. So we have that. We have the fact that she did not say the man at the door was a black man. And again, in this neighborhood in 1966, that might have been cause for alarm for a white woman at home. Not so much today, of course. But in 1966, to have a black man in that neighborhood would have been quite unusual. And with a lot of the victims, as we went forward, they found pubic hair consistent with a black man. In the Lois Dant case, they did not find that pubic hair consistent with a black man. So there's been some speculation that this may or may not have been one of the Cincinnati Strangler victims.
Now, what you say, though, interestingly, is that within weeks, this investigation is stalled, and then on June 10th, a man finds a woman's badly beaten body. Again, this is a feature that we talked about, battered, and so some of these bodies are badly beaten above the head. You're talking about crushing
the skull.
Absolutely.
The June 10th murder in Burnett Woods, that would be our third victim. That was Jeanette Messer. 56 years old. She's merely doing something she does every day. She's walking her dog in a beautiful public park near the University of Cincinnati called Burnett Woods. Sun's not quite up yet. Other dog walkers see her. She takes a normal trail through the woods, and she meets the strangler. Again, we have this crushing blow to the head, and not multiple blows. This is basically almost like a shark would do. Just put the victim down. I mean, unconscious. And in this case, she was strangled with a man's necktie, and her dog was tied to a nearby tree by the killer. And she was found, all her clothing had been ripped off, fractures about the face, strangled with a necktie, and raped in a public park with really quite a lot of people moving about that morning. This was a very audacious crime, I would say, kind of almost Jack the Ripper-like in its daring.
Right. Now, throughout this, you provide an account of what is going on in terms of society, and part of that is the reaction from society based on what the media is writing, and you talk about the Inquirer. And you tell us about the headlines that they had, despite what the police are saying, despite what they may know and what they don't know. What are the headlines and what is contained in the headlines at a newspaper like The Inquirer?
Well, after the third crime, Dan, rather provocative headline, I'm looking at it right now, Negro killed three women, police say. Of course, they're using the term Negro that was used at the time. But the Cincinnati police kind of had to make a decision here. Do we have one killer? Do we have three? And they looked at everything in total for these three murders, Harrington, Dant, and Messer. And they basically came out and said, we have a single killer operating. Again, the term serial killer was not used or coined yet. But after that third murder, June 10th, the word came out that we have a black man killing elderly white women in Cincinnati. And it is the mid-60s. We've got Vietnam War protests. We have race riots, civil rights issues. We've got hippies. We've got counterculture. We've got the Beatles. It's a time of tremendous change.
Right.
And yet Cincinnati prides itself on being immune to change. I think it was Mark Twain that said, if the world was coming to an end, I'd move to Cincinnati and spend 10 more glorious years. So I think the headlines were basically saying, how can this happen here? We're not New York. We're not Los Angeles. You know, this is the Queen City. We're innocent. So how could this be happening to us? I think that was the focus of a lot of the headlines. You know, how could it happen here?
You add the historical juxtaposition, too, that very interestingly, July 1966 is also a time of the infamous killers arising, and you talk about two in particular, Richard Speck and Charles Whitman, and you say they had ushered in the era of modern mass murder, Speck butchering 8, Whitman shooting 13.
Boy, Dan, we'd never seen crimes like this. I mean, there was no template to process Richard Speck killing the student nurses and 2 weeks later Charles Whitman going up top of the tower at the University of Texas and sniping 14 people. We just hadn't seen things like this. I think we've become kind of inured to it today. You know, mass shootings are really not so unusual anymore. But in 1966, a guy kills 8 student nurses, and then a guy goes up on a tower and shoots 14 people, 2 weeks apart. It was just shocking. I was 12 years old. I just remember reading these stories, like, what is going on here? There was no template to process these kind of crimes, and they're certainly a part of this story without question.
Now, you continue with this, too. We talk about July 1966, and by August 14th, back in Cincinnati, the strangler strikes again, and it's a question mark. Barbara Bowman, 31 years old, you talk about a black cab driver, as reported, a Negro cab driver picking her up from Clifton's Lark's Cafe. Tell us about what she's doing at 2 a.m. How does this happen? What do witnesses see? Tell us what police find.
You know, was this the strangler? That was the big question. She was a 30-year-old single woman, obviously way younger than the previous victims. She's drinking in a bar, and she calls for a cab, and a short, slightly built black cab driver comes in. She leaves with him. They are approximately one block from her house at about 2:30 a.m. when this cab driver attacks her. And attempts to strangle her and attempts to rape her in the back seat of the cab. Barbara Bowman manages to break away in a pouring downpour and starts running along the street. And the cab driver pursues her in the cab, runs her over, and then hops out and stabs her in the neck as she's laying in a rain-swept gutter. And she dies there. And the cab is disabled. The cab driver takes off. And this cab eventually turned out to be a stolen cab. And this was a bootleg cab driver who had taken 7 or 8 fares that night, you know, just taking calls from a dispatcher until he picked up Barbara Bowman. So she's murdered. The cab driver escapes. But we've got a younger victim. We've got a stabbing. And again, the taxi cab itself was used as a murder weapon. I think the Inquirer called this one of the most bizarre murders in Cincinnati history. You know, is this indeed the strangler? I mean, there is an attempt at a strangulation, but she was actually run down and stabbed, and there was no rape. So Cincinnati police were kind of divided on this one. If you ask me, that's the strangler. He had an opportunity with this younger woman. I think he took it. She easily could have been strangled, but she was young and strong, and she managed to break away. Was run down and stabbed. But I think this is indeed our perpetrator at this point. But it certainly didn't fit the pattern in many ways.
What did this do for the community in terms of after the headline of three Negroes killed, or Negroes killed three women, or Negro kills three women, pardon me, do you have the composite drawings of the Bowman suspect, and you
yes.
say that black men, especially cabbies, are rounded up. So black men are rounded up for lineups and questioning, aren't they?
Oh, boy. I tell you, I've seen the photos of this, Dan. The Miranda ruling had just been passed in 1966, you know, the rights of the suspect. Yes. Cincinnati was in such turmoil and such fear that basically they were rounding up any suspicious-looking, short, slightly built black man who may have driven a cab, and they were hauling them in for lineups, for witnesses at the bar that Barbara Bowman was at. There were some people that drove by and happened to see the attack on Barbara Bowman and see the driver in the cab. So they were parading these men in front of these witnesses, really without any due process, and civil rights groups were rightfully outraged. But because of the fear sweeping through Cincinnati, no one really cared. People were, again, black men were being hauled in to lineups without any real due process. And the directive went out from the Cincinnati police, if anybody's acting strange, just bring them in. So there certainly was some racial tension starting to grow at this point. And the heavy-handed investigating tactics of the Cincinnati police certainly didn't help matters at all. But again, everybody was so afraid. I don't think anybody was worried about the rights of the suspects when this was going on.
You say before anybody can really get their bearings, by September, a woman named Virginia Hinners, 40 years old, is accosted by a black man. And she tells police, and she survives, obviously, she says that this guy says, do you want what the others
yes.
got? And it's
yes.
right across
and
from where Emma Jean Harrington was killed. So
She is right across from the Claremont Apartments where Emma Jean Harrington was killed in December of 1965. Short, slightly built black man assaulted her and the janitor and said to her, do you want what the others got? And Cincinnati police flocked to the scene of this assault. This had all the earmarks of the strangler. You know, he found a woman alone in a church office and made a serious attempt to strangle her. But the custodian coming in kind of saved her life. But again, we're back in Walnut Hills. We're right across the street from the scene of the Harrington murder. So this appears to be our perpetrator, the Cincinnati Strangler, once again, in a failed attempt.
Now, there must have been another composite drawing. Did it compare to the other ones? And what is the result of this composite drawing? What is the reaction overall, the city, the police, with this further attack with Virginia Hinners?
Well, the tension is really heating up. You know, those composite drawings, they were kind of all over the place. There were several of them. They didn't really get any hits on those. No one really recognized this composite drawing. When I look at who was eventually arrested, I don't see really a resemblance But I think as September rolled in, this attack, everybody was again on kind of a heightened alert. When is the Strangler going to strike again? And of course, within days of this attack on Hinners, we had a completely different kind of crime occur on the west side of town.
Right. You talk about October, Dell Ernst, and two nights later, an attempt to strangle a 48-year-old woman. But tell us about the attack on Dell Ernst, 69 years old, and this is in October.
Wonder if I could just back up just a second, Dan?
Sure.
Again, 3-4 days after the Hinners attack, a family of three, the Gerald Bricka family, was knifed to death in their home on the west side of Cincinnati. And we've already had Lois Dant and Barbara Bowman killed on the west side. And this was a lovely family, a Monsanto engineer, his beautiful ex-airline stewardess wife, and their 4-year-old daughter stabbed to death in their home. And the initial reaction was that this was the Cincinnati Strangler. Extremely heightened alert when this family was butchered in their own home. It's hard to talk about the Cincinnati Strangler without mentioning the Bricka family.
Absolutely.
And, of course, as this turned out, the perpetrator of the Bricka murders was not the Cincinnati Strangler. There was no relation to the stranglings. Sad to say that 51 years later, the Bricka murders remain probably the most notorious cold case in Cincinnati history, unsolved to this day, just like the stranglings are. So the city's on high alert, and this beautiful family is butchered in their own home. Again, wasn't related to the Cincinnati Strangler, did nothing to ease the tension in the city. And as you said, we had an assault in early October, a very nice part of Walnut Hills. A woman named Dell Ernst was attacked in her hallway by a short, slightly built black man who had asked her for directions somewhere. And again, this has all the earmarks of a strangler attempt. So we start rolling up toward October 11th at this point, which was another significant date.
Right. Well, you want to talk about Alice Hochhausler?
Boy. Well, this was really the climactic event of this saga, Dan. She was a 51-year-old wife and mother of 9 children. Her husband was the chief surgeon at Good Samaritan Hospital. They lived in the gorgeous Clifton Gaslight District. Fine old homes, gaslights, a very elite neighborhood. And on the night she was murdered, Alice Hochhausler was out picking her daughter up from her job at Good Samaritan, dropping her daughter off at the daughter's apartment because she was afraid that the strangler was going to get her daughter. And while they were parked in front of the daughter's apartment, a car pulled up behind them, a 2-tone Chevy with a lone black driver. This fits the description of a driver in a car seen near some of the stranglings. The man eventually drives off, and Alice Hochhausler lets her daughter off, and she drives home to her house, parks near the garage. Her husband and 7 of her children are asleep inside. She has 40 feet to go to the safety of her back door. She never makes it. Strangler hits her a crushing blow on the driveway, drags her back into the garage, rapes her and strangles her with the belt of her bathrobe. The woman was dressed for bed. She was merely picking her daughter up and dropping her daughter off because she was worried about her daughter. I mean, the irony of her murder. She wouldn't even be out at midnight on October 11th if she wasn't worried about the strangler killing her daughter. And the strangler kills her 20 feet from her back door in one of the nicest neighborhoods in Cincinnati. And Dan, the fertilizer hit the fan with this one. This was a prominent victim, prominent in the arts and charitable work. This is a one of Cincinnati's finest neighborhoods, and the Strangler has really come home to roost and taken a high-profile victim. And, you know, police will tell you we investigate all crimes the same. But when the victim is high-profile, they obviously spend more time. So this, again, this spawned the largest law enforcement mobilization in Cincinnati history. I'm looking at a massive headline now in the Cincinnati Inquirer. 5,000-man posse beefs up hunt for sex maniac. This was Kennedy assassination in Pearl Harbor font. And the 5,000-man posse was milkmen, mailmen, delivery drivers, meter readers, anybody moving throughout the city was deputized to look for a lone black man in a two-tone Chevy. And, I was in seventh grade then, Dan. Never seen anything like it in this city. A complete mobilization. We've had 5 murders attributed to the Strangler, and we've had this beautiful family, the Brickas, butchered in their own home during this same time frame. The fertilizer has hit the fan in Cincinnati. And you know, Dan, they moved Halloween to the daytime.
Yeah, incredible.
That year, yeah.
You talk about the Bricka murders, and you talk about Alice Hochhausler, so two high-profile,
incredibly within 2 weeks of each other.
Within 2 weeks of each other. And you say now the newspaper headlines, they were frenzied, feverish coverage. And you say that coverage was nothing since, well, hadn't seen anything like that except the coverage spawned by the Cummingsville Railroad Killer in 1904, which you write about in your Chapter 1 in this book.
Chapter 1. Very similar to that, actually. Of course, those were the, back then, 1904, 1905, that was kind of the heyday of the yellow journalism. They loved that sensational kind of thing. But I'm looking at other headlines here from 66. Grim manhunt on for Mad Strangler. Series of sex crimes shatters calm of serene Cincinnati. It was, I would say this was perhaps unprecedented, more so even than the Cummingsville Ripper of 1904, 1905. This was, without question, the largest law enforcement mobilization this city has ever seen. And Dallas Hochhauser murder is what really, really brought that on. You know, to have a victim of this stature murdered just steps away from her own back door with her husband and 7 of her children inside. This crime was beyond audacious. This was the boldest crime the Strangler had done. There was an outdoor barbecue going on two yards over. There were 20 people there. Nobody heard or saw anything. This woman was killed on her own driveway. Yeah, Halloween moved to the daytime. The fear was rampant in the month of October.
You talk about a press conference where they linked Alice Hochhausler's murder to the other murders by blood type.
Absolutely.
And you put again just incredibly exactly 1 year apart from the Krekko and.
Almost to the day. Really, 1 day short of the 1 year of the Krekko attack. And, you know, police have been looking at these tips about a short, slightly built black man, but they've got nothing. They know nothing about this man. They don't have a single solid lead. And, a crime expert predicted that the Strangler would next strike in December. And I think, as you know, Dan, from reading it,
sure,
they couldn't have been more wrong about that.
Yeah. Tell us what happens. You talk about Rose Winstall. You talk about how the police link the 4 out of the 5 attacks in Walton Hills and Clifton area, but still no suspects. And then you talk about they even pulled state hospital records for the criminally insane and mental hospital patient records.
Oh, all of it.
But Let's talk about what happens with Rose Winstall and what happens in this case nationally afterwards.
Well, this was really unusual that the killer would strike within 10, 12 days of a murder. And this was also in Clifton, though you couldn't get much more different from where Alice Hochhauser was murdered in the Clifton Gaslight District and Rose Winstall was murdered in Coryville, which is kind of a seedy neighborhood, a part of Clifton. This woman was 81 years old, and this crime varied in a number of ways. There was forced entry. The killer actually had broken down her door and attacked her while she was asleep. She was way older than the other victims. She was beaten way more severely than the other victims, almost like it was a personal attack. And instead of leaving the victims spread-eagled with a ligature around them, in this case, the killer actually covered her face and tried to jam the body under the bed. And police responded to this, and there was some question, is this our strangler? Because this woman had been living with her brother up to about a week before the murder, and he had been moved to a nursing home. So she was really living alone for the first time in years. And the forced entry, that's something we haven't seen at all. And the age of the victim, this woman was half blind, 81 years old. I mean, she's not anything close to a sex object at this point. I mean, whoever this killer is, he just really wants it all. I mean, this is an absolutely depraved crime. There were bite marks on her body. Again, I say she was beaten way more severely. And then it was almost like the killer, I've seen this before, was ashamed of what he had done and tried to hide her body under the bed. And this was not how the other victims were left. The other ones were kind of displayed, so whoever found them would be shocked. This was almost like a killer who, like, was ashamed of what he had done. So we have another murder 11 days after Hochhauser. Is it the strangler? I think it is. And Newsweek magazine, finally, the strangler goes national. Newsweek magazine has an article about the Cincinnati strangler based on the Rose Winstall crime. And suddenly we've got national exposure to what's going on in Cincinnati. I'm reading here from Newsweek, 5 such killings in 10 months had made the signature fearfully plain to Cincinnatians and yet hard for police to read. So we've got our 6th victim, and police have nothing, absolutely nothing. They are powerless to stop this man at this point.
You talk December 9th, police get a good tip, and
boy,
an incident with Sandra Chappas, 22-year-old. Tell us about her run-in with somebody while she was driving.
Sandra Chappas is 22 years old. She works downtown at the Kenner Corporation. And it's slightly after midnight on the 9th, and she's an attractive 22-year-old woman walking home to her apartment just a few short city blocks in downtown Cincinnati. Of course, during the reign of the strangler, a few short city blocks can be awfully long. A car pulls up beside her. It is a 2-tone Chevy with a lone black driver. He starts shadowing her. She gets within sight of her apartment and runs into the apartment and runs up the stairs. The driver stops the car, hops out, and starts chasing her up the stairs. She manages to get to her apartment. A neighbor hears the commotion and peeks out and sees a short, slightly built black man panting in the hallway like a dog and grabbing his crotch. He sees her. He bolts, almost runs into this woman's husband coming out the door, and he has the great presence of mind to note the license plate number of this suspect and repeated it to himself until he got upstairs and could write it down. So we have a license plate number of a suspect who attempted to attack a woman on December 9th. Seems like the police really have something here. But as you know, 8 hours later, the strangler, one block over from where Sandra Chappas was menaced, the strangler takes his seventh victim. I mean, this is really audacious. There's police all over downtown because of this Chappas assault. And yet this guy slips through the net, kills 81-year-old Lulu Carrick when she comes home from church, strangles her in the elevator of her apartment with one of her stockings. No rape this time. This is, an incredibly bold crime on a Friday morning with people going in and out of this apartment constantly. So no time for a rape. Just strangles this 81-year-old woman in the elevator, and police respond. And at the same time, they finally trace this license plate number to the driver of that car, and they show up at his workplace to arrest him.
You talk about the suspect, Postiel Lasky Jr., 29 years old. You talk about when
Postiel.
Postiel. Thank you.
Postiel Lasky Jr.
Yeah, you talk about what police question him and his disposition at that time. But you also talk about that he was questioned earlier, and also tell us a very, very interesting thing regarding cab driving.
Yes, he was a former cab driver. They brought in witnesses to the Barbara Bowman situation, people that saw the cab driver at the bar. They identified Lasky as the cab driver. And indeed, they've got the cab driver's voice on tape from the night of the Bowman killing, and he's using the same call number that Lasky used when he was a cab driver. So...
Wow.
People, witnesses to the Bowman case, start coming forward after Lasky's arrested and identifying him as the cab driver who picked up Barbara Bowman. And they've got a really good case against Postiel Lasky Jr. for the murder of Barbara Bowman. Two women who had stopped to ask directions of the cab driver as the attack was proceeding against Barbara Bowman identified that cab driver as Postiel Lasky Jr., as did all the witnesses in the bar and several people that rode in the cab with Lasky before he killed Bowman, because he was taking fares. He was driving people to where they wanted to go in a stolen cab and pocketing the money. So he's identified by numerous witnesses, and he is charged with the murder of stabbing death of 30-year-old Barbara Bowman in the month of December. Now, is this the strangler? Good question. Good question. Is this the strangler?
The police did not conduct an investigation and lay any other charges as a result of this, or afterwards, after these charges were laid, there was no other further charges mentioned or talked about. Even though
they
the
had
police
a really,
had done.
I mean, this guy, this Lasky guy. He had a sheet as long as my arm. This was a man who had four previous convictions and prison terms for assault. And on October 9th, Dan, 1965, he had assaulted a 16-year-old girl very severely, and he was given probation. And he was out on the street later that day on October 9th, and 3 days later, Elizabeth Krakow was attacked in Walnut Hills. And I've seen this with disorganized serial killers before. They get tired of being identified by their victims. They're going to continue to attack women that just don't want to be identified anymore. And it's very possible that Postiel Lasky, as he hits the street, you know, some judge astoundingly giving him probation, he could have made a decision at that point, I'm going to start killing these women. So he is charged with the Bowman murder, and he is tried, and he is convicted, and he is sentenced to death. And the Cincinnati police say they have no comment on the six strangulations. Lasky is never charged with any of them. All those six strangulation murders of the elderly women remain unsolved to this day. Postolsky remains the prime suspect in those cases.
You also talk about the NAACP, and they didn't like when the black men were rounded up, and again, their constitutional rights were obviously
not at all
violated.
Yes,
but
not
now
at all.
With this verdict, go ahead about tell us about what the reaction to the verdict.
Well,
they
didn't really like the trial either. This was an all-white pro-death penalty jury. We had white witnesses claiming Lasky was with Bowman. Lasky had witnesses claiming he was home that night, mostly family members.
Right.
So we've got a jury believing the white witnesses over the black witnesses. We've got Lasky sentenced to death, and a lot of unrest occurred at this point. And Lasky's conviction and death sentence eventually led to a major race riot in Cincinnati on June 11th. We had a week-long race riot, which two government commissions linked it to the arrest and conviction and death sentence of Postolsky. Black community felt this man had been railroaded. They felt that the strangler cases were hung over his head during his trial for stabbing a woman, and that he was being convicted of being the strangler, not necessarily the killer of Barbara Bowman. And it led to a serious race riot in June of 1967. And you know, I don't think Cincinnati's ever been the same since these events. This is not the kind of thing that was supposed to happen in Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, a serial killer, racial tension, this kind of thing. We really kind of went through the fire, so to speak, from 1965 through 1967, and I think it kind of shattered Cincinnati's image of being this nice, innocent, clean, conservative Midwestern town where nothing bad ever happens. But, hey, something did, and seven women died. And it's still kind of a mystery. You know, people still tell me when I give talks on this program, well, Postolsky was the strangler, right? And I have to remind them, he's the alleged Cincinnati strangler. He has never been convicted of the six rape strangulations of the elderly women. He was convicted of stabbing a 30-year-old woman in a taxi cab. That's the only case he was convicted of. And he died in prison in 2009, proclaiming his innocence throughout. He got a death sentence. But when the Supreme Court outlawed the death penalty, he got off death row along with the Manson family, Sirhan Sirhan, Richard Speck. All those bad actors got off death row free. So that kind of wraps it up there as far as this story. But quite a story, eh?
Yes. You talk about one last thing, though, that one police officer mentioned that had been involved with this. He said the killing ceased once Lasky was arrested.
You know, they did indeed, Dan. We had some additional assaults afterwards. I like to say there's two myths about serial killers that both come into play here. One is that they never stop. Well, that's silly. They definitely do stop. Jack the Ripper stopped. Zodiac stopped. BTK stopped. Texarkana Moonlight Murderer stopped. Hillside Stranglers even stopped. They do stop. And the other myth is that serial killers are white males. But if you look back through the history of serial murder, black serial killers basically occur roughly around 12% to 13%, which is basically the occurrence of black people in the population of this country. So the representation of black serial killers mirrors really the representation of our population. So there are black serial killers, and serial killers do stop. And the stranglings did stop. You are absolutely correct. Some people take that as like the main piece of evidence that Lasky was the strangler, that they stopped. I don't. I think two of these cases, Lois Dant and Rose Winstall, those don't seem to fit the pattern. It looked like a killer who maybe knew the victims would be alone. Right. I think Lasky did some of these, but possibly not all of them.
Let's get back to the case that intersected, and a very, very important case and fascinating case, too. And we mentioned it, Gerald Bricka and his wife, Linda.
Oh.
And you call it, in a chapter you call A Vision of Deadly Desire and the Bricka family murders. And this is right in the midst of this Cincinnati strangler that never was caught,
before,
as we say.
It's 2 weeks before Alice Hochhausler. Yeah, it's 2 weeks before. I've never seen a case like this. The rumor mill is still active after 51 years. I give talks on the west side of town about the Bricka case. I'll get 200, 250 people showing up. This case has haunted Cincinnati for more than half a century, and you can't separate the Cincinnati Strangler from the Bricka case. You just can't. And the Bricka case narrowed to a single suspect, a prominent veterinarian who was linked romantically with Linda Bricka. And this gentleman lawyered up, and they were unable to interview him further, and the case stalemated for more than half a century. But it is the most notorious cold case in Cincinnati history. If you ask me, the second in Ohio history behind the murder of Marilyn Shepard in Cleveland, which is also a mystery these days, you know, with Sam Shepard acquitted. But, yeah, the Bricka case is just, it's notorious. I get rumors about it all the time. Recently, some people have linked a beloved kiddie show host in Cincinnati in the 60s with the Bricka murders. And indeed, this man was interviewed in conjunction with the investigation in 1966. You can't separate the Strangler and the Bricka case. But the Bricka case, I think because of the murder of the child, you know, the four-year-old child who obviously knew the killer, it just incensed people. And my next book will cover the saga of the Cincinnati Strangler and the Bricka family murders and what Cincinnati went through in 1966. I'm hoping to have it out by the end of the year. We'll see.
Absolutely. We won't get into all of it, but again, just for those curious, you talk about the four-year-old daughter, and you talk about, maybe we could just go through the crime scene just as a sort of prelude to what you'll be writing about later, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the program to talk about that. So
I
let's
hope so.
Again,
we still have enough time?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Let's talk about exactly who this family was. He was 28 years old. His wife was Linda, and very beautiful. We alluded to that. And they had a four-year-old daughter, Debbie. So
Debbie,
tell us who they were, and before we get into this actual incredible crime scene that, again, galvanized police, confounded police, and has captivated Cincinnati and a bigger audience for over 33 years.
Well, really for 50-some years now. It was 1966. Gerald Bricka was a young engineer at the Monsanto Corporation. They had transferred here from Seattle. Rising star in Monsanto, upwardly mobile, workaholic, putting in 80-hour weeks. His wife was a stunning former airline stewardess. They had a beautiful four-year-old daughter named Debbie. I'm looking at the pictures of this family right now, and you've seen them in the book, Dan. And Sunday night, September 25th, 1966, Jerry Bricka was seen taking out a garbage can, spoke with a neighbor, went back into his house, and the family was murdered probably within 15 minutes after the neighbor saw him outside. Stabbed to death. Killer wielded the knife maybe 25 times, killer or killers, because there's certainly some question about that. I've seen the crime scene photos. Pretty bad stuff. Jerry Bricka was an extremely muscular young man. Linda Bricka was dressed in a skimpy negligee. He was stabbed in the back and in the neck. She was stabbed in the chest and the neck and thrown on top of him. So they're kind of spread-eagled on top of each other in the master bedroom next door. Four-year-old Debbie appeared to have been dragged from underneath a bed, stabbed four times. The knife went all the way through her body.
Yeah.
Now, the family is not seen on Monday or Tuesday. Tuesday night, neighbors have noticed newspapers piling up, garbage cans still at the curb. Jerry has not gone to work. Neighbors investigate. They open the front door. They are assaulted by 48 hours worth of death wafting out of this house. I mean, the neighbor who leaned in the door said he knew what it was the minute he did. And police descend on an absolute atrocity of a crime scene. Just a vicious, vicious killing. Jerry Bricka had two socks stuffed in his mouth and a piece of tape. His carotid artery had been cut, and he was probably gurgling, and the killer stuffed the socks in his mouth, I think, to shut him up. There was some question about whether Linda Bricka was raped. The coroner initially said she was raped. Lead investigator eventually said, no, she had recent intercourse. And the semen they took out of her is part of a DNA profile that exists today. And they were able to verify that she had sex with someone who was not her husband within 24 hours of her murder. And along with that semen, they have Marlboro cigarette butts and some human hair found clasped in her hand. So we've got a DNA profile on this one. I wish I could say it was a really good DNA profile. I've been told by investigators you're not going to get an O.J. Simpson number. It's not going to be 1 in 7 million. Be more like a 1 in 25 kind of thing. They've sent it through CODIS, known offenders, no hits. But, of course, we've got a prime suspect in this one, Dan, who's deceased. So remains to be seen what's going to happen. But I'm telling you, there's not, you know, you can link the strangler to this case. There's no two more notorious cases in Cincinnati history than the Cincinnati Strangler and the Bricka family murders. And they all coincided in 1966, probably one of the most frightening years in Cincinnati history.
The FBI is involved in this, and unlike the other crimes that they report that a black man or a Negro is on the loose, do the FBI determine if this is a black man or a white man or white men or black men responsible for the
murder? Well, they sent a lot of evidence to the FBI lab. I mean, this is 1966, Dan, pre-DNA. You know, municipal labs are pretty rudimentary. If you've got something complex, you go to the FBI. And the Hamilton County was investigating this case. It fell outside of the city of Cincinnati. So you've got the city of Cincinnati investigating the Strangler, and the Hamilton County Sheriff's investigating the Bricka case. And the county was very quick to put a headline in the paper, Bricka Killer Believed White. And they did that specifically to head off possible vigilante action. I think if people thought a black man had killed the Bricka family, I think we would have had some serious harassment of black people in the city. And county put that out there specifically to let people know this is not the Strangler. The Strangler did not kill this family. It was a white man. And they determined indeed that it was, based on the evidence they had, based on the hair and certain other things. But, you know, it's easy to trash the victim in cases like this. Linda Bricka was a stunningly beautiful woman. There's no question about that. She had a troubled marriage with her husband, and she appeared to be having a relationship with a prominent veterinarian in the area. Linda Bricka had a tremendous love for animals. She was an animal rights activist long before that was fashionable. And This veterinarian had two interviews. He certainly incriminated himself in the second interview by his demeanor and his answers, and he lawyered up immediately, and they were never able to talk to him again. It just stalemated.
You
until
talked
that,
about
until,
some...
Until his death in 2004.
Now, did something happen in 2004 that made anyone have a renewed interest in this case or not?
Well, what was interesting is our suspect and his wife attempted suicide together.
Oh.
And he died. And she lapsed into a coma. But there was a suicide pact from the main suspect in the Bricka murders. And, you know, they've since reopened the case. Now they have a DNA profile. I was actually on the task force in 2014. I've been given complete access to all the files. I tell you, Dan, I thought about this case for a long time, and I always thought it was a single killer. When I saw the crime scene photos, and I saw the physique on Jerry Bricka, even in
right.
death, I think it's multiple killers now. All it was looking at the crime scene photo, and the whole crime changed for me, just looking at those photos. I don't think one man could have handled him. I mean, if he thought his family was in danger, I think he would have fought like a tiger. So I think we've got multiple suspects here, probably one with a gun. And this family was slaughtered without Jerry putting up a fight. There was no sign of a struggle. They had two aggressive dogs who were found locked in a basement playroom, and the dogs possibly were drugged. And again, the tape on Jerry Bricka's face turned out to be veterinary tape. There's all kind of clues in this crime that would point to a veterinarian. And indeed, our prime suspect is a veterinarian. But there's actually a number of suspects. I have a list of about 15 bona fide suspects. But that vet's number one, without question. It's a chilling case. And you've got the beautiful victim, the workaholic husband. You know, it's the 60s. There's wife swapping going on. There's swingers. There's key clubs. You know, all this kind of stuff in conservative Cincinnati. And the rumors of her affairs started almost immediately upon the finding of the bodies. It seemed like everybody seemed to know this woman was stepping out and possibly got her family killed. Yeah, I'm totally obsessed with this case, Dan. I think you know that.
What's interesting is that it seemed that the knife, it was a carving knife, possibly used as the murder weapon, which was missing, but also that the carver's knife was also part of the home itself. So that is another interesting question, isn't it?
Knife was missing. People always thought that carving set had been kept hidden away, and that someone who was familiar with the house knew where it was. Actually, I've been told by someone I interviewed who babysat for the Brickas that the carving set was out on the buffet. The fork was still there. The knife was missing. The knife was 6.5 inches long. It certainly fit the wounds. Was never found. But this was a confident killer or killers who managed to control the dogs, control the family, use of ligatures, the family was tied up, no defensive wounds, no neighbors heard anything, and the houses were very close together. There were neighbors out and about. People were at home watching the television premiere of Bridge on the River Kwai that night.
Wow.
60 million people across the country watched that movie. And the Bricka TV set, 2 days later when the bodies were found, was found on that channel that was playing the movie. So they apparently had settled in to watch this movie. Jerry had just gotten home from work on a Sunday night when the killer or killers arrived. Just a stunning case. It just gets under your skin like a splinter. Everybody that looks at this case becomes obsessed with it.
Sounds
and yes,
like
we had a
life.
Strangler running around at the same time. Just an astounding year in Cincinnati for crime. It really was.
You talk about the crime scene itself. Tell us if this is your deduction or partially police deduction, that it seemed that it wasn't ransacked, but rather that incriminating evidence was removed.
There certainly drawers were pulled out. It looked staged. Nothing of value missing from the house. And again, the speculation was were incriminating things linking Linda Bricka to the killer, perhaps taken. The killer or killers appeared to spend a long time in the house after the murders. The Monday morning paper, which hit that driveway about 2:30 a.m., was missing. Could have been used to wrap a knife in. Could have gone in the Bricka garbage cans, which were picked up that morning. You know, we don't find the bodies until Tuesday night about 10 o'clock. So the first 48 hours in this investigation are gone. I mean, the police are already hamstrung. I mean, witnesses, you know, 48 hours go by, people start to forget what they saw or what they heard. You know, I mean, you know, can you remember something you saw or heard two or three nights ago? Probably not. So it was kind of hamstrung from the beginning. And as we see in a lot of crimes back then, Dan, the crime scene was utterly compromised. There was no clear jurisdiction when the bodies were found. There was a period of about 90 minutes when this crime scene was not controlled. Numerous first responders wandering through, firemen, EMTs, cops from four different jurisdictions. I interviewed several of the people in the house. They said people were picking up things and looking at them, you know, wandering around. And finally, Hamilton County took control and kicked everyone out. So we've got a probably a compromised crime scene, but you know, back then, Dan, almost all crime scenes were compromised. You just had to weed out the stuff that the detectives brought in, basically, against the actual evidence. So the one big rumor was that it was a screw-up. And the other big rumor about why this case wasn't solved was it was a cover-up because the suspect was so prominent and that somehow the police let him skate, you know, or they kid-gloved him kind of thing.
Right.
And I see no evidence of that. They put surveillance on this man for years after this crime. They were following him into the 1970s, and he continued to run his veterinary practice over there. So they never let up on this guy, but they just didn't have enough to go to a grand jury with. I mean, they could link him to the female victim. His demeanor and behavior was very suspicious. He did not have an alibi for the murder night, but that's just not enough. And he refused to cooperate. He didn't supply fingerprints, blood, or hair, and he got himself a very good lawyer. Very good
right.
lawyer.
I was gonna
and
say.
the whole thing just stalemated. Yeah.
The other employees were interviewed, and this is how it led to him being interviewed, and then his behavior raised some red flags, you say. But was there
yes.
anything to the idea that he was a 45-year-old man, maybe spurned by this 23-year-old beauty?
He was actually 35.
Okay, 35.
He was married with five young children. He, from what I've seen, he was a bit of a hound. Linda Bricka would have been she's only 23, just a stunningly beautiful woman who loves animals, and she appeared to really enjoy working with veterinarians. They actually interviewed, Dan, seven veterinarians in conjunction with this case that knew her. That's how crazy she was about animals. But during the second interview, he was unable to account for his whereabouts that night, and they caught him in several lies. Like, literally, you're lying, and here's how we know that. And then he terminated the interview and immediately went out and lawyered up. And that was it. They never spoke to him on the record again. His lawyer gave them such restrictive conditions for a third interview, the police refused to do it. And
right.
It just stalemated. you know, I guess they could have had a grand jury subpoena him. I spoke with a county prosecutor. Would you have done something different in 1966? And he said, I could have called a grand jury. They could have subpoenaed him as a witness, and he would have taken the Fifth, and that would have been it.
Yeah.
So sometimes you've got a clear suspect, and you just can't make the case. For whatever reason, you cannot make the case. And that's what we have here. And the Bricka murders haunts the West Side to this day. I have people on a waiting list for this book about this case. And in my new book, the Bricka case will be the A plot, and the Strangler is the B plot, because you can't separate one without the other.
No. What was the media response to them not making an arrest, and how much did they know about the suspect, and what did they write about that suspect? How was
he was never identified, never officially identified at all. But, you know, I was able to learn who he was. And, you know, I see headlines like neighbor of Bricka cleared, police want certain man. Bricka probe narrows to single suspect. One Bricka suspect remains, police admit. Here's one that's particularly on the anniversary of the Bricka murders 1 year later. Prosecutor believes he knows who killed Bricka family. Pretty much just putting it out there.
Right.
The prosecutor said, you know, here we have a man who killed three people, but there were no witnesses. And because of the Miranda ruling, we can't grill this guy.
Right.
You know, we've been deprived of those tools by the Supreme Court. And, you know, so it just stalemated. I know it was frustrating for all the law enforcement people. I've interviewed the wife of the lead investigator who's passed on. She said he was haunted by this case, never got over it. I mean, he was unable to close the biggest case of his life. And she told me he was quite positive that the veterinarian suspect was the killer. He had no doubt in his mind that they had basically brought this investigation to this guy's doorstep. They couldn't close it. I've been obsessed with this case since it happened, Dan. You know,
yeah,
and you know, I was already, everybody was afraid of the Strangler. And suddenly this beautiful family's butchered at the height of the Strangler terror. Like, what is going on in Cincinnati? And it's interesting to me that the Strangler really got very little publicity. I mean, people today, they know who the Boston Strangler, they know the Boston Strangler case very well. But they don't know the Cincinnati Strangler. People don't know this case. And by the way, Dan, Albert DeSalvo was not the Boston Strangler. And I think that's a great show for another time.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
I'd be happy to talk about that, but
absolutely.
Yeah.
It's one we haven't covered at all whatsoever. So many murders and so little time. So.
Well, that's one we should maybe talk about at some point. The only evidence against Albert DeSalvo was his own confession, which included the similar errors that were in the newspaper. He had a photographic memory. I think he just memorized the accounts of these murders, and he was interrogated by a guy who asked him leading questions. You know, like, what color was her bathrobe? Was it blue? Yeah. I think the Boston Strangler was a number of different killers. In the case of the younger victims, there were clear suspects that knew these women and had reason to kill them. But it all got grouped together under one killer. So that would be a good show for another time, definitely.
Absolutely. Speaking of conclusions and deductions, you do that in this book. So tell us this unique sort of aspect of your book and why you decided to do
that.
Well,
I've never seen it done this way. And, you know, Dan, I wrote this book for true crime people. You know, I didn't put 20 photos in the middle of the book. I've got 150 photographs spread through each chapter. As you know, on my on each beginning chapter page, I have a picture of the crime scene as it looks today. Pictures of the victims immediately. But at the end of each case, I did a thing called eyewitness, not an eye in my head, but eye as in me. And I wrote used a different font. I wrote in present tense, and I recreated the murders, and I pointed the finger. This was my attempt to solve them. I've had some of my fans of this book say, boy, those eyewitnesses were really something. Who wrote those? I said, I did. Well, it would read so different than the rest of the book. And I said, it's just, you know, I'm trying not to leave people hanging. I don't want people to finish the chapter and go, wow, I wonder who killed them. This is what I think happened. I've had a really positive response to that. Never seen that done in a true crime book. But, yeah, I don't skimp on the photos. True crime people like a lot of photos, don't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, they don't want them, in the middle of the book. You know, don't you hate that, trying to turn into a middle section to look at a photo and then turn back to your chapter? I would never do that to my readers. The photos
are context,
where you
though.
Need them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So the eyewitness thing, people seem to like it. Kind of reads like a little short story. I was able to kind of stretch my novelist chops a little bit there. And, I named the killers, you know. I'm giving it my best shot. I think, you know, these are all cold cases. I dedicated the book to the victims. My attempt to achieve a sense of social justice for them. I didn't want these people to be forgotten just because their cases weren't solved. And I've talked with a lot of family members, and I think people really appreciate what I did here to get these cases back out.
Tell us about your task force involvement. Tell us more about that.
Oh, the Bricka case?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was invited, one of two civilians, to actually come and look at the Bricka file. And I had been attempting to get into this file for more than a decade without any luck. The Hamilton County jurisdiction refused anyone access to this file. They would say, you know, it's an unsolved case, so there's no freedom of information. And I reminded them at that point, unsolved status does not preclude a freedom of information search. Now, the sheriff at the time who was guarding this file retired, and the new Hamilton County sheriff was able to let me in. And we had a series of meetings with detectives, had some action items assigned, looked at suspects. I went out and interviewed more people. And unfortunately, the two detectives eventually got swamped with actual current crimes. We met off and on for about a year. Basically, I believe my forthcoming book, will be the best chance of solving this case. Our prime suspect's been dead since 2004, and I don't see DNA solving the case at this point. I wish that wasn't so, but I don't think that is going to happen. So it's kind of on me now. I'm the caretaker of this story. The Strangler, the Bricka family, and you know what happened to Cincinnati in 1966. I mean, people really need to look at this. It's two crimes that haven't gotten a lot of national publicity, but as sensational as anything else that was happening around the country as far as crimes. I mean, seven women murdered by a serial killer, beautiful family of three murdered in their own home at the same time. Richard Speck, Charles Whitman, Valerie Percy, the daughter of the senator in Chicago, was murdered the week before the Bricka family. I mean, it just really a lot of high profile true crimes in 1966, without question.
You talk about a 300% increase in either violent crime or murder in 10 years in Cincinnati.
Yeah. Back then, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what the statistic said. there had been a real upsurge in violent crime in the 60s. It wasn't just these high-profile cases we've been talking about either. I don't know if it was just a byproduct of the 60s, racial problems, Vietnam protests, hippies. It just really seemed to be a major upsurge in all kind of crime during that decade. And if you look at Queen City Gothic, my table of contents, 5 of my cases took place in the 60s. It's the most represented decade of the book by far. And really the most high-profile cases, Patty Rebholz, the Brickas, the Strangler, the Dummler triple murder in Mount Lookout in 1969, all of these unsolved, just waiting, just sitting there waiting to be opened by somebody, like a present under the tree that's still sitting there. Quite a year.
And you talk about the fascination with these cold cases, too, these unsolved murders. And this book, you say, being very important in the city of Cincinnati and being a bestseller there. Tell us also about just a little bit about Queen City Notorious. And before I let you go, maybe tell us how people might be able to look at your other work. Go to your website. Tell us a little bit about that contact information.
Sure. I wrote Queen City Gothic changed my life. I was able to retire from a 32-year business career on this book. It was a regional bestseller. The Public Library of Cincinnati had 60 copies. The book was on hold for 18 months.
Yeah.
Literally, copies came in and they went right back out. Certainly sold a lot. And several detectives I worked with, these old cold case guys, said, "Hey, JT, great book, but we kind of looked like we weren't very competent in some of these cases. Can you write a book where we solve the cases?" And Queen City Notorious is that book. It's dedicated to the detectives. Some extremely high-profile cases in Cincinnati where you actually get to meet the killer, see the trial, see the punishment, and these are all killers next door. These are all ordinary people, for the most part, that were driven to murder, and some of them are some of the most unlikely killers you will ever see, and yet they've killed. And this book was my ode to the detectives. I think it's a great book. It has not sold as well as Queen City Gothic. And based on my research and what people tell me, people want mystery, not justice. I watch a lot of crime shows. I like to see justice.
Sure.
But there's something about the lure of a mystery. People just can't get enough of the mystery. And Notorious has done well out there, and I'm glad I put it out there. I wanted to show how an investigation is successful. They won these investigations. These killers were caught, in several cases electrocuted. There's something about the lure of the mystery. But both books are available on Amazon or anywhere else books are sold. My website is jttownsend.com. I have a Facebook page, JT Townsend, True Crime Detective, which has got tons of stuff about these cases. I encourage people to get on there and certainly like the page. My website has some longer pieces. I was on Coast to Coast AM radio a couple months ago talking about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. Have a lengthy article on that on my website, with exclusive photos from inside the house where this child was taken. And I don't know anybody that has these photos. So if you want to see the room where the child was taken and what the inside of the house looked like, hop on jttownsend.com or hop on JT Townsend True Crime Detective on Facebook. I point the finger right at Charles Lindbergh. I will kid you not.
Well, it's been fantastic. I want to thank you very much, JT Townsend, for coming on and talking about Queen City Gothic, Cincinnati's most infamous murder mysteries. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
Dan, I appreciate you having me. I'm looking forward to a future program.
Absolutely. Can't wait till next time. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And have a great evening.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.